Wait for it, wait for it, and we're live. Hey, all you crazy sci-fi and fantasy fans. It's time for your daily dose of shenanigans over here at the Blasters and Blades podcast. Just a couple of nerdy veterans and one chaos coordinator geeking out over our science fiction passions and fantastical fantasies. A place where magic is king, the sky is the limit, and space is the place. We are the podcast that puts the fun in dysfunction. So without further ado, I'm going to let our guests introduce themselves to our listeners and viewers at home. So we're going to start with the legendary Mr. Bill Frisbee. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, sir?
Sure. I am a nerd turned Marine turned nerd turned geek. So I've gone scale. I write military science fiction. I write fantasy. I've been playing war games since the 80s, maybe 70s. Started out with D&D First Edition and been loving it ever since.
Okay, so that many turns, did you end up right back where you started?
No, I ended up in a lot better place. Now I can afford all the games.
Oh, that's important.
And I don't have to photocopy them for my friends.
But do you have the time to play the games now that you can afford them? That's the trick.
No. I don't have a group. That's why I turned to writing.
Okay. Well, you need one more turn to get to actually finding a group then. So, yes. So for all of you at home, his links will be in the social media, in the show notes. And if you want to reach out and start a group with him, I mean, you can adopt this lonely Marine. All right. And with that being said, next we have Mr. James J.E. Pittman.
Hey, everybody. I'm James Pittman. J.E. Pittman is what I write under. I do the Felix Chance series of urban fantasy, speculative fiction, and also the Pandora Squad, action, sci-fi, military, fun goodness. Longtime nerd, longtime geek, and like Bill there, I also don't have any groups because, you know, time, but, you know, it's been fun. It's been still fun.
Outstanding. And next we have the mini personalities of Miss Jana S. Brown.
Hi guys, I'm Jana S. Brown. I write speculative fiction under Jana Ray, including some military sci-fi romance, because you have to add a little bit of spice to your power armor. And I do have a group. I have the same group that I've been gaming with since college. So we're going 30 years strong. And we have played every system known to man, it feels like. There's some weird ones out there, and they're fun.
Weird is fun. I'll agree with that. All right, and last, but certainly not least, we have Mr. Michael LaVoice.
Oh, hey. Yeah, I'm Michael LaVoice, author of Galaxy's Most Wanted, available at Amazon.com now. I am a long-term fan of MechWarrior. As you can see, I'm wearing my official Team Banzai MechWarrior shirt. We have did you guys get a good shot? There we go. All right. But I'm also a fan of giant stompy robots from way back in the day, all the way back to the proto giant stompy robots on an old Japanese television show called Space Giants. That's how long I've been into these things. And everything from there to now. So this is a near and dear to my heart kind of topic, man.
All right. So the next part of the introduction, dear listener, dear viewers at home, is how we first met. So we actually all met when we were taking our Megazords for a stroll. And then we realized we were all part of the same cool club. And then, you know, when we united our powers for good or evil, well, we won't say. And the rest, as they say, is history. But, yeah, so hopefully we don't end up like that poor Red Ranger did. It's a sad, sad day for him. You're looking at us like we're crazy, Bill. Do you not know what happened to our friend, the Red Ranger?
I don't think I've heard that one yet.
He went a little hard on the nose candy, ended up stabbing his roommate with your samurai sword, as you do, and then walking down the California freeway naked, waving his samurai sword at passing cars.
Cool.
Can you imagine filling out that police report? Well, see.
I had a friend who attacked a squad car with a katana while nude after he dropped some acid. I was not doing the acid with him. I always had this habit of being the one straight guy that didn't drink or do any of the drugs. But I sure watched a lot of craziness, and that was one of my favorites.
Yeah, I could see that being nice. I'm assuming that he did not win that endeavor in the car one.
He did not. he didn't.
Mass tonnage and all that generally helps. Speaking of mass tonnage with the giant stompy robots. All right. And next, before we pass go, we have to do the religion question because we have a first time on the Blasters and Blades podcast, although certainly not the first time we podcasted together because Bill was on the Sci-Fi Shenanigans back in the day.
Oh.
Back when he was a baby author, before he was like selling gazillion copies. But are you ready for the religion questions, Bill?
Go.
All right. Star Wars, Star Trek, or Firefly?
Firefly, hands down.
Excellent answer.
Always.
Yeah, he tells you there's no wrong answers, but he lies because we all know what the right answers are. And you can say.
It's Firefly.
Always Firefly. Keep going.
Because you can't take the sky from us. You just can't. That's true.
You can't.
All right. Game of Thrones, The Wheel of Time, or Chronicles of Narnia?
The Hobbit. Old school.
I like it.
Yeah.
When we first started with the rebrand to do the all of spec fic, we did have the Lord of the Rings on there, but everyone picked that one. It just wasn't fair to everyone else, so I tried to mix it up a little bit just because we're considering that. I mean,
well, the Lord of the Rings is good, but I grew up with a Hobbit.
Did you watch the old cartoon?
Yes.
The Bank and
Rand. I had the little book that came from the cartoon.
Oh, nice, nice. I did too. Excellent reading material. Scare the crap out of you as a little kid.
That and Conan, the comic book.
Oh, yeah.
That was my youth.
Yeah.
Did you get the black and white Savage Sword of Conan magazine, too? Yeah.
Yes. Stars and Stripes in Frankfurt, Germany.
Oh, yeah.
And Gru
the Wanderer. Yes.
Yes.
Love Gru. Yeah. Used to pick those up at the Stars and Stripes in Giebelstadt.
Uh-huh. I got them in Frankfurt.
Yep.
We really need to do an episode on Conan now, adding that to the list. See, every one of these episodes breeds like a dozen more. All right, and because we are civilized here at the Blasters and Blades podcast, we are no longer knuckle-dragging troglodytes. Sir, coffee or tea, and how do you take it?
Tea, green tea, unsweetened. I'm getting old.
Okay.
Yeah. I can't stand water, so that's my option.
Okay. I mean, in the South, tea is only drank one appropriate way, which is sweet and iced. Unfortunately, I, too, am getting old, so I don't drink that. I drink water or other things because, you know, don't want to die early of the diabetes.
Yes, that's the key.
You don't want to go that route.
I've heard it is not pleasant. I watched it affect family members, but now I am adding the Conan to our list of panel topics.
Yay!
All right, and with that on the list, we are going to dive right into the topic that brought us here. So we wanted to talk about mechs and giant stompy robots, and we're going to start with what does everyone think the difference between a mech and a robot is? Where are those lines different?
Primarily, just to me, a mech is something that is piloted. It has a pilot. A big stompy robot can be a big stompy robot without a pilot. But a mech or a mecha is piloted. That's to me. That's just.
I would second that. That's kind of my line there is,
same.
You know, Optimus Prime. Not a mech. But he's definitely a big stompy robot.
Yes.
But he's his own person with his own will as compared to, you know, Gunbusters or lots of the early 80s anime where we had all the mecha and they were all piloted by people.
But couldn't you get a person aliens. Inside the Optimus?
Not Optimus, but RC, later Spike's son, rode as a when they did the head transformers, and so they did have a human component, but the robot was still able to function without them, but they could become part of them. And this tells you that I watched way too much Transformers. but they did have that. They
is
did
there such a thing?
Yeah, there's no such thing as too much.
Well, some of the latest ones got really really weird. They weren't fun anymore. They weren't stompy robots anymore. Then they become stompy primates. It was bizarre. But going back to, I'm a G1 girl. That's where my heart belongs when it comes to the Transformers.
Beast Wars was fun.
It's all right, but
No, I haven't seen that. They're watching like that out there right now in the living room of this Airbnb where we rented up here.
No, I mean like the early 2000s bad CG, 3D CG cartoon they did. That was fun for me, I thought. They actually had a really good story.
I agree. The story was good, but it was early CG. And like I say, Optimus to me will always be a truck. So it was weird to see him as a...
Optimus Prime was actually in Beast Wars, briefly.
I did not see enough of it.
Because what happened was they went back in time to when the Ark actually crash landed.
Oh, right.
And so they had to go eventually find the Ark in later seasons. That's how they got home to Cybertron eventually.
Sweet.
So now Transformers needs its dedicated own panel. I'm noting
that. I was sitting here, of course, always like I do, a little research before the show. And this is such a massive, massive topic. You're going to need more than one. You're going to need more than three shows. You could do a whole show just on Battletech. You could do a whole show just on Transformers, like you said. There's so many iconic shows out there. Don't even get me started on the anime angle. Holy crap, there's so much.
Did you guys watch the Mech Cadet show that Netflix put out, which I think was an adaptation of something from Japan, because most of that stuff is. They did one of those as well, except for the mechs were also sentient in their own right. So technically, they would be giant stompy robots as well.
What was that one called?
It's Mech Cadets was the name of the show. Netflix has it.
Okay. Huh. I didn't see that. I was wondering if it was based off of a comic book I was reading. It's called Mech Cadet U, Y-U. So I don't know if that was any relation or not.
Let me see.
The internet says Mech Cadets is based on Boom Studio comic book series Mech Cadet U by writer Greg Pak and artist Takeshi Miyazawa. There we go. So, according to the internet, yes, in fact, it is connected.
That was a good comic run. I enjoyed that one. I think Boom Studios is American. So, yeah, it heavily Japanese influence, but you know, it's American giant stompy robot.
Yeah, I enjoyed that one. I watched that one with the kids. Totally for them, but I would recommend it. When you have young kids, you can get away with watching stuff that people might look at you weird for as an adult, because you could just blame it on them. Totally. It was there the reason we were watching it. Had to make sure it was okay. I had to pre-screen it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep, you had to be sure. Okay, so question for you guys then. So we have piloted mechs, and we have autonomous robots. What about power armor? Because it's not generally got the size and the payload that a mech does. Is that just enhanced armor, or does it still put it into the realm of big stumpy robots, things like Bubblegum Crisis?
See, those tend to be more stompy.
Those all had stompy stuff.
I'm thinking they tend to be more stompy. Like if you go like Exo Squad, which is basically one step above like a power loader. Mm-hmm. As far as the mech component goes. So, I'd say it qualifies as giant stompy robot because, you know, they're at least going to be like 8 foot tall. So, you know.
Yeah, I mean, you've got what was the size of the stuff in Heavy Gear? That was, were those about power armor size or were they larger? That was a game I never got into. So I'm not sure. But even in Battletech, you had the elementals from the clans, which were several meters, at least 2 meters tall, if not more, because the pilots themselves were bred huge to drive the things. Power armor in, I can't remember the name of the game. It's one of the games I researched for my next series to kind of inspire me for the power armor in that. And in my next series, the power armor is they're 2 meters tall and change. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think they qualify. They're just, by definition, power armor has got to be categorized as mecha because it has to have somebody in it.
Right.
Yeah. Right. My thought process there is that if you can move your arms around, I mean, if you actually look at the armor, I would say a big stompy robot is something where your arms are in tight and you're controlling it another way. You know, because powered armor is, you can go into a building, you can go into a spaceship, and you can fight. But if you start to get too big, you're not going to fit in there. So that's kind of where I draw the line, is actual size. You have to be able to go into a house, and powered armor, you can do that. But a big power suit, 3 meters tall, that's not going to work. So, and your enemy is going to exploit that.
I think of power armor as like a suit. Obviously, you strap into power armor, right? So it's sort of like knight and shining armor, but cooler. So you're not encumbered by like a machine, whereas with mecha, I think is more, it's a mechanized vehicle instead of just armor. So whereas power armor is the suit of armor, mecha would be the horse you ride it into. And so for me, like, I think mecha is more like bipedal tanks more than anything.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, that's what attracted me to BattleTech at first, because I'd always been into armor. I loved tanks when I was a kid. If they had a war movie, I wanted to see the tanks. My dad was in Patton's old unit when he was in as a tanker in Korea. And so I've always been attracted to armor. And so to have great big walking tanks bristling with cannons and lasers and missiles, oh, yeah, I'm in. I'm so in. And did that tabletop for a long time before the video games came out. In fact, we would have all of the losers in my unit in Germany would have these big weekend long BattleTech tournaments with hex maps spread across two dorm rooms. We had field artillery units. We had a whole nine yards on that thing, man. And yeah, we had no lives, but we didn't care. We were having fun.
Well, and you get the aerial side too, because like Robotech, it was planes. It had the three forms: the planes, the robot, and then the one that was kind of half and half, where it was a plane that had arms and legs.
Yeah, in BattleTech they called those a land air. Yes,
the land air mechs, and so you got a lot of that Macross Robotech, that whole BattleTech adjacent, all of the fights over who got to call what, because there's a whole historical thing that you could go into on that property alone that we will not touch because it's in depth and it's really, really, really nerdy. But yeah, you had a lot of that crossover of which kind of vehicles were they, and yeah, a lot of planes, and I loved the aerial stuff. The aerial warfare was fun for me.
Oh, yeah, and that was a cool thing about BattleTech was you didn't just have to restrict yourself to the robots, although you could, but they had a separate standalone set of rules for the aerospace fighters, and they had separate standalone rules for infantry units and tankers. And yeah, there you go. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, if you can see that.
Not focusing really.
Put
there
it
we
in
go.
Front of you.
There yeah, you yeah, go. Yeah. Which technical readout is that? What year? Because that's kind
of probably 80s or 90s. I'd have to look. It's old. It's ancient.
Hey, I resemble that remark.
1987.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, that's about the time I started playing tabletop. And then we got in, when I got into my military unit in Germany, to find out that there were other BattleTech players there. Oh, man, that was just the best. That was awesome.
So do you guys have a preference between the mechs versus the giant stompy robots, or do you like them equally?
All the things, like all of them.
Yeah. They all have their place.
They all have their place, yeah. I mean, I've got a soft spot in my heart for MechWarrior, basically because, like I said, I fell in love with the game, played it for a number of years, then got into the video games, and then had the distinct honor. I wish he could have joined us tonight, but he had another engagement. Friend of mine, George Ledoux, who did the voice of Duncan Fisher in MechWarrior 4 Mercenaries, the guy who gave me my very first voiceover job in the video game industry back in the day. Super nice guy, but they had this aspect of the game where you were in an arena on this gaming world called Solaris 7, and you had different leagues you could play in to win the big prize, right? And it was like, what if John Madden called a gladiator match between giant stompy robots? And that was Duncan Fisher. And I had the pleasure to work with him in an actual MechWarrior Leagues situation where we had a radio broadcast of the games, and the owner of the league actually contacted him and convinced him to come in and do sounders for us and stuff as Duncan Fisher. And then he actually went live with us a few times. It was so awesome. That was great.
Nice.
I mean, you want to talk about full immersion into the game experience. That was it, but it didn't get better than that.
So do you think that there's a franchise that got the concept of mechs the most correct?
As far as video games, or I mean, where do we go there? Because Mech Warrior is the classic for video games all the way through. Yep.
I would say the Aliens franchise, because their mechs were actually loading equipment, which is the from a tech perspective makes the most sense where you would start, because we could make mech suits now. We have the technology, we just don't have the battery capacity. But if they could have a cable that constantly plugged into power, we could make them now. There are some that a company in Japan, a robotics company in Japan, has that they take to conventions and stuff to show. So something like industrial uses makes sense to me.
So something like that, you know, you talk about the alien mech suit, you know, going back to anime, Pat Labor, that's very similar. Yep. It was essentially power loaders they started using for police action and other things like that, patrol units. So, you know, there's a distinct evolutionary line between, you know, the outgrowth from, say, a utilitarian, like, loader-type mech to other uses to just going straight up, like, with a Gundam that's basically, you know, it's your jet fighter slash martial artist slash samurai dueler slash
awesome
power armor. Yeah, just general purpose awesome. That.
So it's going to follow the... I suspect it follows, the evolution follows much like the airplane. So first we had airplanes, but what do we do with them besides fly around and look cool for farming events? Oh, I know. We use them as spotters. And then some brilliant guy said, I don't care what the rules say. I'm going to drop a pineapple grenade out of it onto the troops below. Mm-hmm. And someone said, oh, crap, they don't like that. They're shooting at me now. Okay, let me add guns to my plane. And sort of. And then before armor, you know it, you've got dedicated airplanes that whole mission is fight other airplanes. Mm-hmm. I suspect mech armor will take the same course.
Well, and your power armor already has the beginnings of a course where they're working with people that have got problems with paraplegia, problems with brittle bone syndrome, things like that. The way that the prosthetics are changing, both for actual prosthetics and for support devices, that is becoming more and more mechanized, where you get that, and that's in real life, much less the display we see in something like the Marvel Universe when Rhodey gets it's clobbered, and so in Avengers Endgame, he's wearing from the waist down. He's got the it is almost mech that allows him to walk around, the power armor, and then that works with War Machine, and you get big stompy robots there with both Iron Man and War Machine doing the stomp around and blow things up. The Hulkbuster, I mean, you don't get much more stompy than something big enough to stomp the Hulk.
That's actually, when you talk about, you know, integrating man and machine, they actually have recently, so we're recording this in late February, Elon Musk just announced they're doing trials for like nanites that'll somehow allow you to merge with machine. And right now they're testing it on people who can't walk, the quadriplegic, to see if they can, you know, basically strap them into some sort of suit that gives them mobility back. I don't know. I mean, can you imagine the inconvenience of walking around at the grocery store and suddenly you get a Windows update? I mean, come on. I don't know that I'm
rebooting now.
Yeah, rebooting. And you know, it's always the most inconvenient time. Like, oh, I'm driving down the freeway. Sure, do an update now.
6 hours later, you're leaned up against the freezer and frozen foods.
It was a Gundam series that kind of took on that angle of things, Iron-Blooded Orphans. It was, they found this ancient mech that the most powerful ones were able to, like, you know, have a symbiosis with the mech. But the consequence was, and, you know, they could move the mech like it was their own arms and legs. Trouble came when it got its arm blown off and the pilot lost the use of his arm, unless he was connected to the actual suit. And by the end, it progresses to the fact where he can't live outside the suit after so much damage he takes. But at the same time, the suit basically replaced his central nervous system.
Richard Fox did something like that with his Iron Heart unit in the Ember Wars. So, I mean, it's a concept that people, or, you know, you could do the same thing if an EMP goes off and you somehow short circuit. Although I would think at the point we can develop those, we could probably Faraday cage the hell out of it. But I mean, you could look at it that way too. What happens if you're networked into the system when something like that goes off? Because
there was a
bad.
I'm sorry. There was a book series called Warstrider, where they were neurologically linked to their mechs. So if the mech took damage, there could be feedback, electrical feedback that comes back into the brain and causes problems. So,
lethal neurofeedback from a computer system, that was pioneered in the 80s by William Gibson. That was one of the part and parcel aspects of cyberpunk, was your Decker could get his brain fried from black ice operating against him. You know, and so they just carried that concept into, okay, physical damage to the robot can mean mental damage to you, and you may come out of that thing and not be able to walk again.
So how would you classify then something like Avatar, not the airbender, but the blue man, where the guys that were controlling the avatars on the planet were actually in a tank connected to it, like mentally, with those, you know, fleshy bodies that they're basically mechs? Would you call them mechs at that
flesh
point?
Mecha? That sounds so X-rated.
I would say more like drones.
Okay.
In that case.
Yeah.
But you bring up an interesting point. Avatar, they did have mechs there in Avatar.
Mm-hmm.
You had the Colonel, and that was like an offshoot, like from Aliens. They took the alien power lifter, and they just strapped weapons onto it. So that was
The power mechs in the Matrix.
The
last one, those with the weapons that had the. They were actually moving it themselves, so they're quasi piloting. It was almost power armor, but almost a lifter, and it had that same look.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those were cool machines. I would take one for a spin.
Yeah.
Okay, but would you do the Pacific Rim treatment? Jump into one of those bad boys.
Yeah. I don't remember the fallout of those, but I mean, I'm tempted to say yes to all the things because I was young and dumb once, and I did lots of dumb stuff, but.
Oh, the Pacific Rim being, I guess, I didn't know what to expect going into that property, the first one that I saw. And being a Battletech guy for so long, I just automatically had locked in my head one pilot, one suit. And to have, two pilots that have to merge? What is this kind of touchy-feely bullcrap? Well, I just didn't. I didn't like it at first. And then, of course, then it won me over with the weapons and the boom and the kaijus. But at the same time, I was not a fan of that dual pilot system at all.
Well, the dual pilot system just set up how badass Idris Elba and Charlie Hunnam became because they were the only ones who could pilot them solo.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Of course, it's Idris Elba. Come on.
I mean, yeah. Well, he canceled the apocalypse.
It's true. It is kind of a carryover from, again, going back to anime, the early things like Voltron, where you had multiple pieces, each piloted by somebody different. And in order to reach the ultimate stompy robot, you had to join all the pieces up. And if they were without one of the pieces, then your stompy robot was much weaker, which was often a plot point was to say, we're going to deprive them of the ability to form the ultimate robot, because if they do that, they'll form the Lazian Sword, which they always did, and the monster will have no chance.
Right.
But that was, you know, you saw that in both versions, both the vehicle version and the lion version, where it was always, it was five pilots capable of individual things, and then ultimate power was always about bringing it together to form the most ultimate form of whatever the thing was.
Yeah, Voltron, Power Rangers, you know, that plot device was used all through like the 80s and 90s, that where you had to combine to, I'm guessing, theoretically spitballing here, they didn't have enough juice in the individual robots, so you had to have the power cores of five or six different ones to do the amazing blazing sword or, you know, whatever giant robot.
Which would make a lot of sense.
Yeah. And that way you could have your specialized ones doing different things for the small things like the flyers or the tanks or the whatevers. And then, you know, you pull them all together to finish the monster off at the end of the day.
No. Well, but, Transformers did it because you had Devastator. Mm-hmm. You had some of those that were, you know, individuals, and then it was transform and combine to become bigger and even scarier.
And from the writer side of things, I think it's important that you have different people because then you have the conflict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So if you just have one pilot, it's about one individual. But if you have five of them, then you could just take it in all sorts of different directions.
Yeah, but if you've got, several pilots that have formed a unit, mm-hmm. you know, for example, the book I'm working on now, these are a bunch of guys who were playing on power armor. Basically, you take the NFL and the WWE and Mech Warrior, and you throw it in a Yahtzee cup, and you shake it up and dump it out, and that's what you had. And they were using it to end war in their time with warfare by proxy. But you've got these guys that are big, larger-than-life athletes with all the attitude of Randy Savage driving power armor at each other every weekend. You know, and so there was lots of room for conflict, even with members of your own team. And so I think mm-hmm. that translates well for things like military sci-fi, where you got power-armored infantry, or even in Battletech, you know, when you had the houses fighting each other, and even sometimes in units, people backstabbing each other. You saw a little bit of that political angle in like Robotech. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. so yeah, I think there's lots of room for conflict, even if you restrict it to one pilot. But I'm not shooting down your point. It's a good point that you have to get these people to work together to form the big robot.
So if you just have one pilot versus five, it makes absolutely no sense for that one lone pilot to shout out the power attacks. You have to have that five voice unison screaming.
Absolutely. It only works that way.
You got it there. Yeah.
Like a resonance power enhancer type thing.
It's totally true. Well, the other interesting thing that did, and that especially the anime around mech did, is it brought women into the discussion of big stompy robots. Because mm-hmm. you got women that hand-to-hand wouldn't have been able to take on other pilots. There really wasn't a place for them in certain warfare because that there are physical differences and you have to deal with that. But when you put somebody into the pilot seat of a big stompy robot, it doesn't matter anymore. You know, they need to be fit. They need to be able to pilot. They need to, you know, have the mental acuity and all that kind of thing. But you got the five-person team and it was almost always at least one girl.
Yeah.
And the girls could watch that and go, look, the princess is piloting a mech. How cool does that make her? It and brought us into the game.
So there's
Gunbuster was awesome. Go ahead, RJ.
There's the old joke that God made man, Sam Colt made man and woman, Sam Colt made him equal. You could carry that line of thought onto power armor, mecha, robots, anything. Mm-hmm. And then even as far back as Heinlein in Starship Troopers, he recognized with those gender differences, women actually are better at certain repetitive tasks than men. So in this, like in Heinlein, he had the women were mostly pilots and those reflexes do carry out. So if you could get rid of something like the effects of G's on the body, you could argue that maybe women were better suited to pilot some of those things.
They make great gunners too.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Sometimes. Not the one I had in Iraq. She wouldn't shoot anything. Had to fire. I don't need a gunner that won't pull the trigger.
Oh, yeah, no.
They might have kids. I don't care. I want to live long enough to have kids too.
Right.
Yeah, so there's definitely an angle where you can involve women in a way that doesn't make them automatically either Mary Janes or Mary Sue's, I guess, or mm-hmm. doesn't basically turn them into men right. that just happen to have lady parts. You can actually make a woman.
Either.
A woman. Right.
Yeah. It becomes an a much more equal thing because everybody can have jobs that they're good at. And it takes out some of that. Well, you know, I'm obviously weaker than you are because you're just built that way. But if they're in power armor, if they're in a mech, that goes away. And so that opens up interesting stories to tell where you can bring women in as your reading audience because we have somebody to identify with versus when, you know, it's all guys all the time. Mm-hmm.
Speaking of all guys all the time, we're going to pause for, well, that's a horrible segue. We're going to pause for a moment and shamelessly steal for the man. And if I wasn't the man today, I'd probably fire myself.
Gunnery Sergeant John Doe is frustrated. He didn't join the Space Corps to be shuttled around in a ship. He joined to fight. So far, he has only seen a few skirmishes. He itches for a fight, something he can use to impress his junior space marines as well as use to pick up chicks. Now that he's aboard the USS Big Stick, he hopes things will be different. The Space Federation has defeated their longtime enemy and has decided another war was just what the people needed. One was intentional, the other was not. Either way, Gunny is excited. Now Gunny and the rest of the ship's crew must fight for their lives against an enemy none of them saw coming. What could possibly go wrong? Dive into the Vacuum Suck Hard, Adventures of the USS Big Stick by J.R. Hanley and Chris Winder and find out for yourself.
That was the story that I wrote that for an anthology that said it was too crude humor. So it was so bad I had to get a Marine to make it more palatable to normies. That's how bad the first draft was.
Yeah, but you can tell it's a good book when your narrator who's trying to do the commercial for you is giggling. Because I can hear the laughter in his voice as he's trying to read that text.
Yeah,
there,
how many takes with that?
Seven. He was laughing because he read the actual story. He's like, I can't believe you published this because it's dang near smut with some of the crude humor. But yeah, this is probably the point of the interview where we should make the joke about two pregnant women fighting. Is that like babies operating flesh mech suits? But we're going to be adults here. We're not going to make that joke.
Thanks, JR.
Just wanted you to know we weren't going there, Jana. Just for
you. I'm so grateful that you didn't go there and that I don't have to, you know, slap you around.
All right.
He'd like it.
Moving right along.
That's not the pot. Family friendly, Michael. Family friendly. All right. Well, so
I just what did I say?
Obviously, mech and robots are fun. Robots, if they're large enough tonnage, they have a limitations of they can only operate in ground that can support their weight. Unless they're in space, in which case, you know, weight's not as much of an issue. But if you look at mechs as basically a stand-in for modern tanks, do you see them as actually being viable? There's a reason, for instance, the U.S. Marine Corps recently got rid of all of their tank battalions because they felt like technology was evolving in such a way that made them useless. So they got rid of them. So I've seen some argue that there is no practical purpose in real life for actual mechs in future combat. So what do you guys think?
I think that's a fact, because mechs are going to be more expensive. They're going to be easy to kill. They've got too many moving parts. You look at the leg. How do you stop a mech? You take out the leg, you know, and then there's the expense. They're heavy. They can't go in. The enemy, if they face mechs, they're not going to go outside their buildings or their towns. So you're going to have to go in after them. So I think there's a lot of limitations there myself.
Do you think that makes them any less cool in books and fiction?
No. I think they're awesome.
I mean, I really
that was the right answer.
Yeah, you know, like Rick Partlow's Wholesale Slaughter series was a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Max. And who was it? Was it Maggart and Cheney got that series called The Messenger? Which is like an absolute giant mech with a pilot inside the head running around saving the universe. But to Bill's point, this was why I tried to keep the power armor in my new series relatively small. I wanted it to be human-sized, and I wanted them to actually be moving it with their arms and legs. So you still have that element of boots on the ground without having the – it's not so giant and stumpy. But it's still that armor aspect. I think that might be something that actual militaries go to. I think Russia already has some armored suits that may have power assist that they've
A couple years ago, they were building robots to operate in space. And as a joke, there's a photo of some senior military Russian officer, and I can't remember who it was now, actually putting 9mm pistols in their hands for it to fire to show that it can articulate. And all the this is before the Ukraine stuff in 2014. So, I mean, it goes back a little bit. But everyone was, oh, my God, Russia is arming space because there's treaties that say we can't do that. I mean, as soon as the tech exists, those treaties go away. We all know that. But while the tech doesn't exist, of course we signed all the treaties.
We probably signed the treaties with the tech existing, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Aliens at Area 51, we know the truth. I will say the limitations that I've seen exploited once in Star Wars on Hoth where you have the bipedal sort of mech, but it was the horse type one, but where they had the X-Wings basically trip them up by tripping up the legs.
Yep.
I do think that was the one thing that they probably got right from a tactical perspective. It made sense.
Well, the Ewoks did it to the AT-ATs too in Return of the Jedi.
That's right.
A bunch of logs downhill and tripped them up with those and had the ropes across in between the trees.
The ending of that movie creeped me out because the Ewoks, basically the giant cuddly teddy bear care bears, when the good guys at the end of the fight needed clothes, somehow they had, in a planet that had no humans, they had clothes to fit them, which tells me those people that used to wear those clothes probably became dinner.
They were going to eat Han and Luke. There was a full feast in C-3PO's honor planned. They were going to eat them. They just changed their mind later. That doesn't mean they didn't go back to it. At the end, they're playing music on helmets, and I'm not convinced that there were not still heads in them. But that is a completely different, you know.
Well, you know, big head, small head changes the tone.
So cannibals in space, next panel.
There you go.
Cute, furry cannibals in space.
Well, technically, they wouldn't be cannibals because they're not their own kind.
He's got a point.
But they're carnivores.
They are carnivores.
Cute, furry carnivores in space.
Yeah, cute.
So how do you determine if they're sentient and thus we can't eat them, or they're space cows and we can make steaks?
I think you have to try each species and see what they taste like after grilling and make your decision based on that.
That sounds good. Does that track with you, James?
Oh, yeah.
All right. Bill, are you already planning the recipes for us? I'm sure you got something planned.
Yes, I've got AI. ChatGPT already has some.
Outstanding. Jenna, I am sure you could make a perfect something too. We didn't want to leave you out.
Oh, I'll manage. You know, I can make desserts out of just about anything.
Ooh, alien. Okay, that's another Cooking with Aliens panel. All right. So,
different panel. Okay, so we're saying mechs couldn't be used for ground war the way that we know it, but a lot of times the place where the mechs come in is when we're dealing with aliens, monsters, things like that. So does it work once we say, first of all, we have a size difference. You're often dealing with large alien ships and things like that, and you get them up off the ground. Because while we talk about big stompy robots, they do stomp, especially in Mech Warrior, as the speakers when my husband plays Mech 5. It's but you see a lot of them that do have some kind of hover or fly, or so can they still be used in other purposes and have it make sense?
I really think it comes down to who the enemy is. Like you're saying, if they're a giant overgrown alien or a, you know, humanoid-ish mech of their own, you need basically the mechs are compensating for the size difference. So you may have something where, you know, it's something you would ideally fight hand to hand, but you can't. So you have a mech to, you know, magnify your hand-to-hand capabilities. It makes no sense when you're fighting little scurrying people, like as we saw with the Ewoks taking out the giant, you know, AT-ATs and the AT-STs, because they're small and nimble. Mm-hmm. Or people hiding in bunkers in buildings where the mechs can't get to, and they would just have to blow it up anyway. So, you know, it just comes down to a matter of who the enemy is and what the end goal is, I think.
And what the rules of engagement are.
Mm-hmm. And I would add to that, I don't think mechs are completely irrelevant and worthless, but they have a very select role. As far as frontline combat units, I think they would just be too easy to take out. However, in a combined arms role, I think they would be excellent. They could sit back. They're incredibly mobile. They don't have to stay on roads. I mean, even tanks have limitations.
Yeah.
But a mech is going to have fewer. And depending on how it's designed, if it's designed with like rockets or missiles or something like that, some indirect fire weapon, then it can sit back behind the infantry, behind the frontline troops, and just launch drones and stuff like that. Yeah.
That reminds me of, what was it? Where the Royals essentially had the mech suits. And so they would be in the back and kind of like this big prestige role. And they would do like duels and stuff like that, while in place of like your armed forces, they would have the armed forces, the infantry and the cavalry and everything doing their skirmishes, but you'd have this giant robot sitting at the back on the equivalent of a horse with a giant pennant and a cape and everything, just kind of as like a prestige intimidation tactic, not necessarily the main force. It was useful in when it came to like dueling or something like that.
And what was the name of that again?
I don't remember what series. I've seen the concept used a couple of times. I know it's not Escaflowne, but that's the idea I get. Because the Escaflowne armor was very kind of royal based. Or Code Geass, something like that. You know, he used it as a status symbol. You know, there are several series that just use it as a status symbol.
Originally, BattleTech was like that. Had the mechs were passed down from generation to generation. Only certain families had them. Everybody else was either grunts or armored tank drivers or whatever. They got away from that, especially when the video games came out. You know, everybody had a mech at that point.
Right.
Especially when the clan showed up. But yeah, prior to that, it was very much like what you were describing. You know, only the rich people had the mechs.
Do you have a preference where the mechs are an everybody weapon or an elite weapon?
I struggle with that because you don't, on the one hand, it'd be great. There was a version of MechWarrior that was put out on the CryEngine called MechWarrior Living Legends. And you had the ability in that game, unlike other mecha games that I'd played up until then, you could leave the mech and get in a tank or an aerospace fighter or any of the other vehicles and fly and pilot and wreak mayhem and then go find another mech and get into it. But one of the core tenets of MechWarrior as an intellectual property was that not everybody could pilot the thing. You had to be able to deal with the connection of the neural helmet and not get sick and not get headaches and be able to do it. And so I think there's a certain amount of that kind of I'm special aspect of being a mech pilot that appeals to me. And I actually included that in this most recent work that I'm working on, where you have to test for the ability to, before they will fit you with the wetware to allow you to operate the Gladius suits, you have to test positive for that ability or they're not even going to spend their time on you. So there is a certain amount of that does appeal to me.
So it's the ultimate plot armor.
Yeah.
You have to be a main character to be able to use it.
Right.
Isn't that like in Titanfall? Has anybody played the game Titanfall?
I have seen it played. I've not played it myself. Yeah, but it's kind of like that where you can get into different ones.
Okay. Yeah. I've seen it. Looks awesome. And it looks like what you were talking about, where you have to be tested. But in Titanfall, it is a big stompy robot. The mech has an intelligence of its own. And then the pilot has to be mentally compatible with it.
Oh, sweet.
So it was
press on it like that, like they have to meld kind of. Yeah.
Yeah. And they get out and the pilot gets out and runs around and it looks like a cool game.
I dig that. That's cool. That's a nice aspect.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's like it's storytelling versus players. Because when you're playing BattleTech, when you're playing a MechWarrior and that kind of stuff, people want to be in the big stompy robots. That's kind of their thing. My husband loves nothing more than to change out all of the parts and add new cool things. And sitting there doing the math, you know, people who say that math is worthless when you start playing games, all games are math. That's D&D is math. MechWarrior's math, because he's there, okay, I can have this tonnage and that tonnage, I gotta eject this thing and I need to find one of these things, and heaven forbid if he can't find a paint job for it, because he loves painting the mechs, and people get into that side of it where they really love the engineering side of putting those together, and in that case they don't want to be denied and say you are not smart enough for this mech. It's like, no, I should be able to drive any mech that I can find and that I can create within the game. And that's different than when we're telling stories about them, because then you can step back and you can say, yeah, this is more of a rare resource because of the way that it's driving the story, whether that's your main characters, whether that's because it's a political symbol. And you saw the same thing in a lot of the, you know, the anime and the other things, is that they were more rare. They would have to be, because really the sheer amount of resource that would have to go into everybody having one. But there is that line, because when you're playing Battletech with all the minis, everybody wants the best minis, and you don't want to say, well, you're not special enough.
So
you drive an urban mech.
There's a source in science fiction that you don't see as much with mechs and robots as you do with, like, oh, I found a spaceship in a junkyard because reasons. So have you seen that done, or do you think that trope would work where it's ancient abandoned tech that you found and somehow you make it work again?
I've seen half a dozen anime that have that. They're basically cobbling together parts for a suit, or they find this one suit and he's like going and salvaging from other broken suits to make this one suit actually work again.
Mm-hmm. Clearly I need to watch more anime, because I don't think I've ever seen any.
Isn't that a movie? That was
one of the main premises of Iron-Blooded Orphans, the Gundam series I was talking about earlier.
Yeah.
I thought there was a movie out that he put together a battle robot to fight.
Oh, that was the Rock and Sock 'em Robots thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Was it Robot
Dog?
Yeah, I think so.
It might have been Robot Jocks. That's what I didn't see. I didn't watch Robot Jocks when it came out because I was mad because I wanted a Battletech movie.
So Hasbro basically wanted to turn some of their games that didn't really have plots into movies. So you got Battleship, and then you got Rock'em Sock'em Robots, which I think they called Robot Jocks or whatever. But
Robot Jocks was more of a Battletech clone, I think. But it was like arena-based robot combat where launch their hand at you and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Are you talking about the one with Hugh Jackman?
No, that's Real Steel. That's boxing. Real Steel,
yeah, that's what I was saying. That reminds me of live-action Rock'em Sock'em Robots.
Yeah, that really.
Well,
does.
And so, Big Sigma Six touched on some of that, because they had the robots that were fighting each other, and then his robot that was not supposed to be a fighter, and their whole plot line there. But they played on that same thing with all of his tech.
That's an interesting point.
You made. Astro Boy, right?
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, there was touch on Astro Boy there. Go ahead, James.
So I've been thinking about it. Big mechs and giant stompy robots are very liberally sprinkled into a lot of stories that don't absolutely actually need them. And a lot of times they're not used in fighting capacities. Like, I remember one slapstick version where somebody was actually cleaning with the giant robot.
Mm-hmm.
And, like cleaning a house or a space station with the giant robot. There was no battle involved. It was just a giant robot made. But, you know, what's some of the most absurd, like, uses you've seen for these giant, awesome, stompy robots?
I guess I'm just a Battletech nerd, but the first thing that pops into my head is that I remember clearly reading several of the novels where they would specifically talk about agrimechs or forestry mechs or these other kinds of, it's the same. In fact, one of the Dark Age books, Ghost Knight by Stackpole, featured a guy who used to be a mech warrior, but now he's running a diesel engine driven lumberjack mech. On this planet where he's cutting down trees, and it's got the same kind of power and the Myomar fibers and everything, but it's just run by a diesel engine instead of a little fusion plant.
So basically he has the, I used to be a mech jockey until I took a plasma bolt in the knee vibe going on.
Well, he was more of a undercover covert agent posing as a lumberjack, but that's kind of interesting.
But it could have gone the other way.
That was Duncan Fisher. he lost a leg, and so he went into broadcasting.
Oh, so, cool. And you do see that a lot where it is any – it's the way that tech comes in anyway. It's what are the big jobs that are difficult to do or require a lot of human labor. The mech is just that next step. So now instead of having six machines that are doing logging – the mech could take over all of that. And so it's always that next step in efficiencies. So you could use a mech in any of those places where it's providing an efficiency, moving away from human labor, moving into more efficient technology.
Maybe. And I could see it used in aquatic purposes for some deep sea mining, maybe, you know, hull repair of damaged vessels, even rescue. At least for some of the grunt work, as opposed to some of the suits essentially they wear now, it would replace that. I could see that.
And scavenge, being able to pull stuff up off the floor, because we can't send much to the ocean floor right now without it going squish pop.
Well, that's another interesting point, is using the mechs' remote controlled devices. So you, as the pilot, you're sitting home comfortable, but you've got this haptic suit on that you can just move the mech around, and it's all remote. So that would make a lot of sense there, you know, and then they could do that fixing ships, and, you know, I could see a lot of uses for that. And that would start to merge the technology into a fighting suit.
Armageddon would have ended a lot differently if they'd had that capability.
Yeah.
Tis true.
Would have. So would The Abyss.
Yes. Excellent movie. Excellent movie. Yeah. Or what is it? The Mega Shark movie where they go into the Meg. There we go.
The Meg, yeah.
The Meg could have been a lot different with that tech as well.
To your point, though, Bill, I do remember there was a series of books by G. Harry Stein called Warbots. And it's where we had developed drone technology to the point where we no longer had to send troops in. They could sit back in a couch and power these warbots to do all the fighting for them. But then the whole premise of that series was people stopped using bots and started fighting hand to hand and with weapons again. And so we had to relearn how to fight war with warm bodies as opposed to robots.
But here's a problem with that too, is if you're using a robot remote controlled, you're not really seeing, you could be seeing what it's seeing, but you could have an altered vision.
Right.
And there was a short video that I saw a while ago, and they were taking crackheads and stuff like that and hooking them up to these suits, and they thought they were playing a game because they would have like some formless humanoid shape that they would shoot and stuff like that. But in fact, they were actually conquering other countries, because what they saw was not what the robot was actually seeing. They had their vision was altered.
Now, that reminds me of Savages from Galaxy's Edge. You got these guys, they're playing video games in an arcade in the 80s in their heads, but what they're really doing is controlling entire armies of attacking robots for the Savages. So that's a dope concept. It's been done several different ways.
Didn't Ender's Game basically do that?
Yeah, too? I was going to say, Ender's Game toyed with that. Yeah. Where the fight against the buggers was all, they taught the kids, and then the kids were remotely doing all that kind of work.
So but they don't feel the what you encounter. So it's a lot different to drop a bomb on someone than it is to stab them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Big difference there. So when you start to go remote like that, your fighters, they don't care. They've got nothing to lose. They don't see what they're really doing to the enemy. And then that makes war just so much easier.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, and if you've got the mechs where, well, first off, if you are remote controlling the mech, is it now at this point just a small robot at that point? If the mech pilot is, you know, a lifetime away in a cushy couch somewhere, is it still a mech suit or is it just a piloted robot?
I would think it would be a mech, because a robot is self-autonomous. It's thinking for itself. It's making its own decisions. That's how I'd classify it.
Yeah, I'd say it would still count as a mecha because somebody's driving it, even if it's remote.
So if you have, as long as you have the pilot in the combat zone, right? So taking that as a premise, there is danger in the delay that you're going to get with the lag time potentially in signals. Because I remember. They wanted us, for instance, when we were in Iraq, to wear hearing protection. But if you wore that, you didn't always hear. Sometimes the IEDs were old, inert munitions, meaning the blasting cap didn't work. So they put a primary explosive to set off the big bomb. And if you could hear the first explosion, which generally wasn't loud, it was just a small pop, you had time to react to not get the big one. If you had your headphones on, you didn't get that warning and you're dead. I could see that kind of issue being a thing if you're in that giant suit, because you're going to be missing some of those sensory issue inputs that the world around you is going to give. Maybe something smells off and you don't realize you just walked into a gasoline trap that's going to turn you into whatever, or you didn't hear that pop and now you stuff. First indication the missile's coming at you is when it smacks you in the face. I could see that being a tactical issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, the further away you get, the worse. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say you get that addressed in several different IPs with the introduction of power armor to take on the bigger robots, like little wolf packs of yeah, power armor, taking apart a larger enemy. And they don't always see them coming.
You've basically described the old American mosquito fleet strategy.
Right, yeah.
You couldn't afford to, in the beginning, you couldn't afford to build ships of the line, so build a bunch of smaller ones and, you know,
death by a thousand. Or the elemental.
The origin of gunboat diplomacy, right?
Yep. What were you saying, Bill?
The elementals in BattleTech?
That's one
example. They designed. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, now, one of the things with communication like that is a serious problem, but then also you can have the computer, it's got its own logic, but then you've got the pilot, they're sitting back giving, you know, macro commands, go here, take out this building, but then the robot has its own programming. So would that be a robot or would that be a mech?
It depends on if it's sentient or not. Is the program a series of ones and zeros, mm-hmm. or is it free thinking? Because if it's ones and zeros, it's still just a machine.
But how do you find thinking? If you've talked with AI today, it could probably convince you it's intelligent.
Could it pass the Turing test?
It did.
Yeah. It does.
I don't know. We're going to have to come up with a Turing test 2.0, I guess.
Yeah, because right now they've got AI that can do that.
So basically you ask it a political question. If the reading of either version of the politics, left or right, I don't care. It doesn't matter. If it doesn't read appropriately for the side it disagrees with, you know, it didn't pass.
Well, you can get it to there's ways.
Yeah. And that actually runs into the issue when you talk about the machine learning that you're describing with the programming that sort of interprets the data. Therein, blind spots of the originator can be a thing. So, for instance, when we're recording this, Google just got an issue with one of their Gemini AI where it wouldn't, when you ask it to input anything, it refused to give you a picture of a white individual, which, you know, is great if you're asking for, you know, tribal Africans in the 1910s. But when you ask for Hitler's Reich and nobody's white, I mean, maybe there's something wrong with that AI.
Yeah.
And so, it's funny to think about because it was very obvious, like the way it did it, but it does raise the issue of the algorithm's only as good as the people coding it.
Yeah, there was another example on Twitter earlier today where a guy had asked an AI a question about, he wanted it to make a rational argument for having four children. And the AI originally stated it couldn't fulfill the request because it couldn't recommend having any children. Least of all four. And so then he asked the same thing to make an argument for having zero children. And it was, oh, well, this is great. This is why you could have zero children and be beneficial this way, this way, this way, this way. And within hours of him posting that, the AI had been fixed so that it could answer the question about zero children and not make it sound like it's trying to control the population.
There was a situation where Marines went against AI a couple months back. I don't know if you heard about this, but they had a robot and the Marines, they butchered it. They killed it. They just totally destroyed it because what they did is they used a cardboard box.
Oh, I did hear about this.
Boxes they came up on it. So it's like, there are a lot of limitations, but if you have oversight.
Did you hear about what happened with the Air Force on the war game they did? So they had a war game where they turned over command and control of anti-missile, like to basically take out SAM batteries and anti-air batteries. And they gamified it to the point where once the human operator was like, oh, no, there are too many civilians, abort that one. The pilot or the rope or the AI code that was running the bomb hunting said, well, no, I get points for killing these SAM sites. I don't care. So it took out the operators. Now, this wasn't real time. This was in a computer controlled whatever. But its answer to that was, well, if the humans are going to stop me from killing the thing I was programmed to, let's kill them first. And so basically it started attacking its operators. The Air Force, it was all over the papers. And then the Air Force was like, no, this was just a thought exercise on a computer. Like, we didn't ever implement this, whatever. But I mean, there's sometimes
no, that's what they
say. That's what they say, right? That's what they want you to think. But it does raise the question about some of the risks mm-hmm. of the coding that you entrust these machines with.
Mm-hmm. Well, that goes back to Asimov and the laws of robotics, which were, you know, supposed to be put in order to keep that from happening, about robotics not, you know, not being able to harm their creator, not being able to allow their creator to be harmed, you know, all of those kinds of things. And you can see if you read a lot of Asimov where that totally doesn't work, because you do get into those logic loops that say, well, the best way to protect this person is if they're gone. And so yeah, go read Foundation and the laws of robotics, iRobot, and some of that kind of thing. It's good deep thought on this kind of thing. And, you know, Asimov was thinking about this a long time before any of us were around.
Which gives you the old, if you look at some of the old dystopian type cyberpunk games where you have one of your classes was that slicer to disrupt the code operating the bad guy's machines. Mm-hmm. Bad guy being
what was, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask, what is Optimus Prime? Isn't that an AI?
I almost think that's
he's robotic an alien.
Alien. I would say alien.
Cybertron is its very own thing that, you know, that that's evolution in a completely different way than what we think of it as carbon-based life forms. So we can't really monitor to say exactly, you know, what is he compared to in an Earth-based computer, because that's a completely different alien evolution. And we see him evolve from the time that, because there's an episode where they go back in time and they see the, you know, the original robot that then becomes Optimus Prime. So I don't know that we can compare there, because he's an alien.
So I know in Transformer mythologies, he is a Cybertronian, which is basically ET species of sentient self-configuring robots. Yep. So in theory, he could evolve on command, but you've just got to hit the I believe button to get to the point where how did the robots become sentient? Because at some point in time, something had to make the robots, right? So I don't know. I don't think there's an answer to that one that would satisfy anyone if you think too hard about it.
That's why we don't think too hard about it. We accept that they're alien
robots and they're awesome. We just watch the show.
We enjoy the toys because, you know, basically a lot of the 80s cartoons were Hasbro wanting to sell us toys and making a cartoon about it.
Yep.
That's all it was.
And we bought the toys and we watched the cartoon and we were happy.
Yeah.
it checked all the boxes for me.
So, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say what Bill brought up about if you program pre-programmed responses into a robot that you then send on a mission. Which led into the AI discussion. That was one of the premises of my next series. The humanity had fought this really bloody war as they expanded into the stars. It was called the Expansion Wars. And they were using AI to help them fight the war until they discovered that the AI had actually prolonged the war by about 10 years working behind the scenes because they were trying to bring about an end to us. And so there was this big desperate final fight. We wiped out the AI, and so no more AI. So if you don't have AI, what do you use that's smart enough to run all the subsystems of a Gladius suit? And I've been doing some reading about something called OI, which is organoid intelligence. It's where they take petri dish grown neural cells and connect them up to play Pong or something of that nature. It's very infancy stage right now. But you extrapolate that out, you could have bio-neural tissue connected to microprocessors running all this code that runs these suits. And it doesn't have
understand you're building Cylons, right?
Yeah, but I'm not calling them that.
Because that's trademarked.
I'm just saying, I'm now thinking of, you know, Starbuck climbing into that ship and it's half goo and it's half...
Yeah,
I mean the bio ship is a concept. The bio ship is a concept that's as old as sci-fi. I mean, look at Andromeda. I mean, that was a bio ship. Look at the Wraith ships in Stargate Atlantis had it. Yeah. I'm sure there are others.
The Isen Vong in Star Wars.
Yeah, and there are biomechs too. Look at Evangelion.
No, yeah,
there are several giant robots that are organically based with armor and that are still piloted by, you know, human creatures. You have Evangelion. I think there was one called Duel I liked about the same time. There are several that are basically organic cells running, like neural network in place of electrical impulses to run the mech suit. That's how they interface with humans.
In my series, The Last Marines, I actually use the Marines' brain cells. They're replicated, and that's what an implanted AI uses. So they have an implanted AI that uses some of their brain cells, and that has the concept of giving the AI an organic component. So if that organic component dies, then that AI dies. So then that gives the AI a lot of incentive to stay with that Marine and keep them alive.
Yeah.
And then there's actual AIs on the side. They don't have that. So they're a lot more bloodthirsty and just very analytical. And it's just a lot of conflict. But I think an AI needs that uniqueness to make it sentient or viable. That's if it's just something you can copy.
Isn't that how they meld the AIs in Halo? They actually used brain scans and like brain cells from Cortana or from Dr. Halsey to make Cortana, if I remember correctly.
I don't recall, but I do know that the AIs in Halo, they would start to go insane after a certain amount of time, which makes sense just because of the data they have to process and keep track of.
Yeah, it's called rampancy, and it basically they learn too much. Their system's overloaded. But I seem to remember that the AIs were modeled by using the brain waves, brain patterns of actual living humans that were smart, they used as models.
I believe you're correct. I think I watched that in the miniseries, the live action show they did as well.
Yeah, I read all the books and watched all the movies, so it's been a while. So we've talked. Go ahead, Michael.
I was just going to say, Galaxy's Most Wanted, one of the features in that was having a person's central nervous system essentially removed from their body, fitted with cybernetics, and then merged with a coded AI. And they became what I called a hybrid AI. And they ran the entire starship, didn't have the limitations. You have two kinds. You have AIs that have to have a pilot because the pilot makes the decision on who you're going to shoot at. And then he flies the ship. The AI is not allowed to shoot at anything that's not designated as a target by the pilot. And then you have the hybrid AIs that were a complete being that were allowed to make the decision on their own because they're part organic and part cybernetic.
But why would anyone want to do that to themselves?
The race that originally pioneered the technology were trying to survive a millennia-long war with a really, really other aggressive species. And so they did that because they were the only ones that could stop them, basically.
Mm-hmm. And McCaffrey did something similar with the ship who sang and the city who fought.
Right.
And you know, people that they couldn't survive outside of some kind of a regulated environment. So taking on being that other half of the AI and working with it, that was a chance to live because they had bodies that didn't work or that were, you know, had never properly formed. That was the ship Hussein came from that. So Anne McCaffrey explored it in a couple of different directions with that whole series.
Interesting. So we've talked a lot about science fiction in the forms of giant stompy robots and mechs. Have you guys seen them ever used in fantasy?
Well, golems are kind of like big stompy robots.
Yeah.
Yeah, Larry.
Don't they have something like Warhammer?
Larry Correia and Steve Diamond did that one. I can't remember the name of the series though. Servants of War.
Right.
But that was powered by the soul of the dead.
Yep.
But I don't think I've ever seen anyone else do it in fantasy.
Not a lot. We see it in some science fiction fantasy kind of crossover. Like there was a Transformers episode where they went to the time of King Arthur and it was all, you know, Sir Knight and this, that, and the other. Transformers The Last Knight, which was a really, really terrible movie and it makes me sad, but they still took that idea. So we do see it where we get that crossover of time travel aspects or jumping to another dimension kind of aspects where you'll see the big stompy robot in a fantasy kind of setting. We don't see it very often. Oh, there's one though. There's one where they built a type of big stompy robot, but it was done very, very silly. And I can't think of the name of the show because they built what looked like a robot, but it was made out of wood and brooms and all of these things. And oh, I have to look it up. But it was very, very silly trying to do the big stompy robot idea in a fantasy second world kind of setting. But not very often. It's very, very rare.
There was one book I read, and there was a series, and the premise behind that was it was a big stompy robot, and the pilot got inside and was, you know, they controlled it from inside, and the suits were passed down through generations, but they were created to fight demons. Oh, and nice.
Yeah,
the Armored Saint, I think it is. But I stopped after the first series or the first book because it just got a little political. I think it was The Armored Saint. But basically it was about, you know, this young girl and she became a pilot for these suits. And there was an Inquisition and all sorts of other stuff. But it was, I think it was done well in that regard. And it was more steampunk, I think.
Yeah.
But
I can see that working in steampunk. Some of that Bronze Age automaton type stuff you could almost envision. Yeah.
There's the Warforged in Dungeons and Dragons. That's a construct race that's a playable race. And that's fantasy. And some of the things that you get, like the goblin siege engines and some of those kinds of things, are pretty darn close to big stompy robots. Anytime you're dealing with the engineering races, then you get that. So you do see it in D&D and in other games that are like that. They just, you know, again, put the fantasy spin on it. But you could do the Warforged, you can do the Siege Engines, you could do... So some of those places, you pick up fantasy that's big stompy robots.
Mm-hmm. I think Escaflowne had a lot of mystical components in it as well, because it was kind of medieval structure to the alternate world they were sent to. And I think the robot actually was kind of a mystical object as opposed to like some kind of actual mech.
Right.
I was just looking it up just to double check, but I do seem to recall that from my Saturday morning cartoons.
Yeah. Well, and they do it in Zelda. My daughter loves playing the Zelda games and the Link games. He's all running around and encountering big stompy robots, some, you know, the guardians that try to smush him. And then in this later one with the Zora, there's a lot of a technology crossover, and there's big stompy things there that they're fighting that are, I would classify them as robots. You're making us think, JR.
What's too big? Here's a question. What do you think is too big for a robot?
No such thing. I've seen them the size of like planets, and I've seen them the size of humans. It's, if you're talking about realistically, it's easy to put an upper limit on that based on physics. But as far as like in media, you know, go to Transformers. You have Transformers that are the size of planets. Literal, actual planets are the robots.
Well, so, if your robot is existing in space, for context, then, you know, size is also a non-issue because the physics won't matter as much. Now, size might limit what it can do one way or the other, but there, you're not encumbered by gravity, for instance, and the need of the weight to support, you know, the base, so to speak. Because at a certain point,
the Macross Super Defense Fortress. And that thing was ginormous and still had the ability to transform and to do its thing.
Yep.
But I mean, like, if you get too big and you're on dirt side, then at a certain point in time, the ground has to be able to support your weight, or you sink in and, you know, sinkhole your way to oblivion. But if you're in space, then kind of all bets are off. I mean, I'm sure there's practical purposes for reasons you would limit size, but that would be by intent and design only would be your limitation.
Well,
if you're in space, do you need arms and legs?
No, I wouldn't think so.
Yes, because it's cool looking.
Exactly.
Cool factor, man.
The aesthetic, dude.
Aesthetic.
Yeah, I can see that. Although you'd never be as cool as Spaceballs, where you got the robot with the vacuum.
That's true. Just suck the air right out. And...
ludicrous speed, I say. Ludicrous speed.
You're going to plaid, sir.
Is everyone around me an asshole?
Okay, now we have to do a panel on Spaceballs. You know this.
All right. And it's just an excuse to rewatch it. I don't think my kids will watch it. Now I have to make them for homework.
Now we have to do a Battletech panel and a Voltron panel. And
I know.
Yeah.
We're going to have lots of podcasts, folks. I hope that you're, you know, strapping for the ride.
Or strap.
All right,
on.
So those are now those are now on the list. So, you know, we're at it about an hour and a half. And I know it's late for some of our guests. So clearly there's a lot more room for future episodes. But what was, dear listener, your first experience with giant stompy robots or mechs? Be sure to put in the comment section, like where you found the concept, what your favorite was. Join the discussion. And if you have more questions for us to discuss, I'm sure I can wrangle these guys to come back for another episode and get nerdy with us. With that being said, I'm going to start up with you, James. What are you writing right now?
So right now I'm finishing up Pandora Squad. It should be released in April. Pre-order is up now. I'm also going to be writing the third volume of the Felix Chance series once I finish that up. And I have a couple other projects in the works. So lots of fun stuff. I've been toying with a giant mech idea. I just don't know where to place it yet. So that's coming up soon.
Which of your universes? Is that what you mean?
Yes, if I can work it into Pandora, because Pandora's already got the giant, you know, reanimated spiders, which are basically mechs at some level. So I'm thinking, okay, maybe I should counter that with a giant fly swatter. I don't know. Or just do a whole new series that's just straight mech fun, you know, just kind of fan fiction off of my love of Gundam and Transformers and Power Rangers and Voltron and all of the above.
Do it. Do it. I'll read it.
I hear a rumor that once somebody dared Bill Frisbee to write My Little Pony Space Marines, and he did it. So maybe we should dare you to write your Gundam.
All right. Yeah, twist my arm.
He made the My Little Ponies in Space actually badass and cool, so he wins with that one. Because I was there.
If we could only release it.
What's that?
If we could only release it.
Why couldn't you?
Kayleen has to go through and do some edits.
Oh, okay. I thought it was done.
No, it's three books are written. I'm just waiting.
Okay. Well, we'll peer pressure her with this episode, Kayleen. We're talking to you. All right. So you're writing that. What about you, Michael? What are you writing right now?
Right now I'm working on book two of Gladius Leagues, the aforementioned Power Armor meets WWE meets NFL kind of a universe. And we've forgotten how to fight real wars with real people, and we're using these powered armor suits as proxies, and all of a sudden, worlds on the periphery start going dark, and we don't know why. Turns out it's alien critters, and we have nothing standing in the way of them except for the aforementioned prima donna warrior athletes of the Gladius Leagues.
So when you watch that, do you eat peanuts, popcorns, or Cracker Jacks?
You're going to want Cracker Jacks. For this one.
Good call.
For the toy inside? For the toy inside, yeah. Right?
Yeah, absolutely. For the toy inside. Hopefully you get the really cool tattoo or the magnifying glass.
Or the mini mech.
Right. Not the lame prizes, like the stickers or the joke book, whatever. Those were lame.
But
yeah, that's what I'm working on now. And Galaxy's Most Wanted Book 4 releases very soon, next month.
You could always join James and write the Gundam analog with him. There you go. Match made in heaven right there.
I don't know, man. Peter Stanley wants me to do a Space Navy deal with him over at Three Ravens. We'll have to do that first.
I bet James could beat him in an arm wrestling contest, and then you're good.
I didn't realize.
Oh, goodness. I walked into that one. Sorry, Peter. I didn't mean it that way. We're going to move on. Jenna, how about you? How are you doing? What are you writing today?
You're going to the special hell, man.
I didn't mean it that way. It was just a joke. And then I realized, which makes it, I don't know if it's better or worse.
Better.
Yeah. Oh, good gravy. I am working on the third book in The War of the Lich that has to come out in April because I promised it to my husband for his birthday. And then once that out, I have a deadline for a romance book. And then I am actually circling back to some power armor stories that are part of my my military sci-fi romance. That thing. So always something to write. It's exciting.
So first off, does the Lich get a power armor?
No power armor for him.
Okay. And does the romance in the power armor mill sci-fi universe, is it between the man and the machine, or is the machine just incidental to the other romance?
You're going to have to read to find out, aren't you?
I guess I am. All right. What about you, Bill? What are you writing right now?
Right now I'm working on the third arc for the Last Marine series. So book 10 is coming out March 15th. And then I can't finish it there, so I'm going to have to write a couple more books on that. But it's going to be leaving Earth, and book 10 leaves it in a very interesting place.
So if they're at the Last Marines, they clearly need better recruiters, so you should probably get them on that.
It's more complicated than that.
So
go ahead.
When you wrote the Last Marine, did you use American Marines, British Marines?
Yes.
Did you kind of all of the above?
Strictly American. They're strictly American. And basically, it's a series about United States Marines in the late 21st century. Essentially, they get Buck Rogered into the 25th century. Four Marines, they get caught in stasis, and then they wake up in the 25th century, and everything's gone to hell. Almost quite literally. Demons are returning. You've got, like, the Nazis are in power. It's a mess. But everything revolves around these four Marines. Three infantrymen and one pilot. And all the Marines, they have implanted AIs, which sets them apart from everybody else. And there's space Nazis, there's Vikings, there's AIs, there's demons. It's just, it goes in some very interesting directions.
I'm so glad I added this to my to-be-read list. This is going to be great.
Read some of the reviews. I think people like it. And if you're military, you're a veteran, you will get a lot of it. Even if you're not, you'll pick up on it.
Didn't Bill Webb do a series like that about people waking up from cryo and like basically
in the future?
Yeah.
But his is all on Earth.
Yeah.
Mine, the Marines are en route to Jupiter to protect a U.S. base there when their ship gets attacked and they get thrown off in outer space.
Bill Webb stuff is more post-apoc than
I know John Henry, writing as Jack Campbell, did his Lost Fleet series with that premise to start somebody's, you know, preserved for 100 years or whatever it was in cryo.
Yeah.
That man out of time, basically your kid in King Arthur's court all over again, but with space. Mm-hmm. I like that theme. Yeah. Did you lean into that when you wrote it, the fish out of water, so to speak?
It was fun, yeah, because they're Marines, and they've got humor from our time. You'll pick up the jokes. You've got the gunnery sergeant. He's the main character, like Clint Eastwood. That's his basic character. And then you've got Private Stathis, which is your smart mouth private. And then you have a super competent sergeant, Sergeant Levin. And then there's the female pilot. She's a shuttlecraft pilot, but she goes a different way. Let me put it that way. So it's a very interesting cast of characters. But when they wake up, AI destroyed America. America is gone and destroyed in an AI war, and they're the only four people with AIs implanted in their brains. And it details the Fermi paradox. You know, why aren't there more people out there? I've got a reason for that. You know, why do we have ghosts in history? Well, that gets explained. Vampires and all that. And
So is it available in all formats, audiobook, ebook, the thing, or is it just ebook and print?
Ebook, print book, and audiobook.
Gonna have to check that out. That sounds interesting. Only 10, you said.
A free short story. Only 10 for now, but I've got a short story out that's free. You can find it on Amazon, but I also have it on my website or I've got a link I could put in there.
So that's almost a Brandon. If you add all 10 of those novels together, your audiobook would almost be one of Brandon Sanderson's. So I think I could do that. That's a week I've got. I'll make that happen. I mean, us mere mortals can't compete with a Brandon Sanderson length novel. So it's no judgment. All right. So since we're talking to you right now, Bill, that really does sound interesting. I'm going to have to check that out. How can listeners and readers and viewers find you on the internet? And it'll be in the show notes as usual.
Everything I try to keep on either Facebook at William S. Frisbee or on my website, williamsfrisbee.com. And those are usually the best ways to track me down and stalk me.
As you do. But don't stalk him at his house. He's got guns, people. He was a Marine. You know, he knows how to hide bodies. All right.
Jim is blurred for a reason.
Janice, speaking of hiding bodies, I mean, what we won't talk about what your husband does for a living. So how can listeners and readers and viewers find you on the wild, wild interwebs?
Oh, they can pop on over to opalkingdompress.com, or they can find me on Facebook under Janet S. Brown Writes or Jenna Ray, or we're not talking about the rest of them. Those are the gushy ones.
Chuck Tingle. Sorry.
Hey, don't ask, don't tell.
I actually made the joke about your husband in the very first interview you were on, and I actually had one of our listeners write me and ask if he really did that kind of wet work for government or whatever. And I'm like, you could ask him, but the last guy that did didn't come back. I'm just saying, it's on you. He'll get a kick out of that, I am sure.
Oh, he will think that's very, very funny. Him and the giant canal behind our house.
Don't test it, FBI. You don't want to know what's in that water. Michael, how can listeners and viewers find you on the wild, wild interwebs?
Well, I am on my own website, michaellavoise.com. You can always find me there. Sign up for a newsletter or send me an email. I'm on Facebook and Twitter as That Michael Lavoise, because it turns out there's quite a few of us out there. And or they can just show up in Millington, Tennessee. I'm probably at Walmart.
So if you're in Tennessee and at Walmart, stop on by. Tell them the Blasters and Blades sent you.
Buy a little cup of popcorn chicken.
Sounds delicious. All right. And so with that being said, those links will also be in the show notes, dear listener, dear viewers. And last but certainly not least, Mr. James J.E. Pittman. How can they find you on the wild, wild interwebs?
Well, first up should be my website, halfacrepond.com. You can find me on the Facebooks at J.E. Pittman Writes and Instagram, Threads, wherever other things we're doing now. I've probably claimed J.E. Pittman, whether I'm posting there or not. You can still find me, or, you know, come see me at a convention or something in person. I'll post my schedule up on the website and on my Facebook. I'm starting off a massive, massive long run in the next couple weeks. I'll be here, there, and everywhere. So just check it out and see if you can find me in person.
We'll do that.
Buy his books.
Buy his books. Buy everybody's books. They like it. So this is the part, dear listener, where I remind you to please be kind and speak your mind on the reviewing platforms. Your reviews help the right readers find the right book, so do your part. And that's especially important with small press and indie authors, because it tells them that you like what they're doing, and they should do more of it. So if you ever wondered why you didn't get book 4 in that series you love so much, well, it's because you didn't review it. It's your fault. Do better. No pressure or anything. I'm just throwing that out.
What are you, Disney now? Blaming the fans? Stop that.
Whoa. Fighting words. Them's fighting words. Keep going.
All I did is ask them to leave one little review, okay? I mean, bad reviews still count if you're telling why. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, don't review a book and say, mm-hmm, these aren't the Jimmy Dean sausages I ordered. But if you say, I don't like it because it had too much cussing, that still tells the listeners who might not care about cussing that this is their book. I have literally bought books off of 1-star reviews.
I had a review that said there was too much swearing in Galaxy's Most Wanted, and I think I had a spike in sales that week. That was fun.
My favorite was one that said that J.R. Hanley writes like a 12-year-old with ADHD wrote gun porn. And I tried to use that as marketing, but Amazon got really mad. You're apparently not supposed to mine quotes there, which is why no one actually does. They just screenshot the website, and they share the screenshot, because then you're just sharing a picture you own, and you get around that. But you can't officially quote what they say. But that was just beautiful ad copy. I mean, I'd have paid him to use it if he'd have let me, but hey. What can you do, people? All right. And you can find us on our Linktree, linktr.ee, Linktree at Blasters and Blades Podcast, where we link to all the things, the bit shoots, the rumbles, the YouTubes, the Twitters, our email, blastersandbladespodcast@gmail.com. We have our Facebook group and Facebook page. And most importantly, we link to Madam Stabby Stab's Instagram, Twitter, and email. So you can send all the hate mail, but she will make you cry. So it's up to you if you're brave enough. And you can find our website at anchor.fm/blasters-and-blades. Again, anchor.fm/blasters-and-blades, where for as little as 99 cents a month, you can help keep the lights on. These episodes aren't free to produce, and every penny helps. Or you can support the show more directly at buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Handley. Again, buymeacoffee.com/author J.R. Handley. Be sure to put in the comment section that it's for the podcast, and I will keep my co-host duly caffeinated. They will drink the Java till it pours out of their nose. It will be glorious. Speaking of coffee, we are affiliated with the coffee brand Coffee, American-made company, roasted in the U.S. And if you use our code PODCASTGRUNTS, you get 10% off. So what's not to love? You're helping American companies do American coffee, and you get high on the caffeine. I mean, you just drink a lot of it till you see colors and hear sounds, or the other way around. I don't know. Just drink it, people. All right. With that being said, totally flubbed my own damn commercial. Thank you for spending your precious time with us. For my crazy co-hosts who weren't here to supervise, so it's really their fault, I am J.R. Handley, and this was the Blasters and Blades Podcast. We'll be back next week at the same time, where we'll indulge our love of nerd culture, cheesy jokes, and all things that go boom. All right. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Michael, James, Jana, Bill, Jenna, Chuck, all the peoples. We're going to have you back for more of these episodes we talked about today. I got to get those on the docket.
Get to work, man.
I'm there for it.
That we are.